I want to thank Maria Alvarez, our executive director, and the board of directors, President Mary Henry, for inviting me. And I really want to just tell you how grateful I am for all the work you do on behalf of New York's older adults. Thank you for everyone who's on the call as well. These are very difficult times for people across our state and across the country. And I know this is especially difficult for many older adults and the people who care for them. Older adults are sometimes isolated from family and friends. Nursing home residents are worried about underlying health conditions and their closed living quarters, which puts them at greater risk. And staff are worried about having enough PPE to safely care for our residents. Sadly, those worries are understandable. This crisis has hit your community harder than most. 1 in 5 COVID-19 related deaths in New York has occurred in a long-term care facility, and residents of color are especially at risk. That's one of the reasons why I'm so grateful and appreciative of this chance to hear from you about the challenges you are facing and to discuss what I've been doing in Washington. Our first priority must be to save lives. I pushed for the last interim relief package that included $75 billion for our hospitals and $25 billion to expand testing. Testing and contact tracing are critical to combating the spread of this virus, keeping our healthcare workers safe, and to reopening the economy. That's why I want to create a national health force, which would put up to 1 million job-seeking Americans back to work supporting COVID response efforts, including testing, tracing, and eventually providing treatment and vaccinations, as well as meeting other public health needs. We have to make sure that everyone can access the care they need and that those providing care can do it safely. We're still hearing disturbing stories about critical PPE not getting to our healthcare workers at hospitals and the residential facilities at the epicenter of the pandemic. I've asked the administration to provide clarity into how health equipment and PPE are being allocated. And I called for the Department of Health and Human Services to ensure that everyone has critical access to health care during the pandemic, no matter their age or disability status. One way we can directly help older adults and nursing homes is through the Coronavirus Relief for Seniors and People with Disabilities Act. This bill would increase funding for nursing homes, improve infection control, cover the cost of treatment for low-income older adults, promote home and community-based services, protect home health care workers, and make sure older adults and people with disabilities have healthy food and other services at home. I've also pushed for the HOPE Act, which would help modernize and streamline access to safety net programs and low-income Americans rely on, like SNAP and housing assistance. I've also pushed for the HEROES Fund, which would provide premium hazard pay to healthcare, transit, grocery store, and other workers on the front lines of the crisis. And last, I've pushed for the IRS to ensure that our veterans and those who rely on Social Security get their recovery rebates. We have a lot of work to do, but I know one thing about New Yorkers, and it's that we are resilient and we are strong, and we will get through this together. Our best policy proposals do not come from Washington, they come from our citizens. And I'm so grateful to have this opportunity to listen to and learn from you directly about the challenges you're facing as individuals and service providers and professionals. I want you to know that I will lift up your voices in Washington as we advocate for more relief. If anybody needs direct help, they can visit my website at gillibrand.senate.gov and click the help button, or you can send an email directly to my constituent affairs at casework, C-A-S-E-W-O-R-K, at gillibrand.senate.gov. I am here to serve you, and again, thank you for all of your time as well as this opportunity, and I'm happy to take your questions.
Well, thank you very much, Senator, for those remarks. And a lot of what you're saying are things that have come up not only through our helplines, but through us asking our members and the community to ask questions of you for this event. So in terms of, I'm going to turn to one topic on housing, and specifically about rent, and it comes from Jerry Goldfarber from Manhattan. And his question is, are there any plans at the federal level to assist renters now, at this moment, with rent forgiveness programs for the short term? Simply giving us a 90-day window without an eviction threat won't be good enough when the 90 days are up.
Yes, there are bills in the works right now to give rental relief, and I think simply giving a 90-day window without an eviction notice is not good enough. So I'm working right now with my colleagues on a $100 billion emergency rental assistance package that would fund and help low and middle-income families affected by COVID. The emergency funds would be distributed to the state and local governments to provide individuals and families with rental assistance for 24 months, a full 2 years, or to provide up to 6 months of back rent. So if you can't afford it and you've been laid off for 6 months, you could have your whole back rent paid for. This funding will basically help vulnerable Americans and families stay safe during and recovering from this pandemic.
Does that apply to seniors who may not be working but are living on fixed incomes that may not be,
yes,
you know?
And it's intended to apply to everyone.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, good. So you had mentioned the money for Medicaid and the different and the HEROES bill, you know, the HEROES funds. Will you be working to boost Medicaid with another FMAP boost? And will you also make sure that the FMAP bump does not end when the White House says that the emergency is over, but throughout the downturn in the economy?
Yes. I advocated and helped secure an increase in the FMAP rates in the CARES Act. I will continue to support additional revenue in the FMAP rate as well, especially for states facing the highest burdens from COVID. And we want to make sure that New York would have the resources to care for people with disabilities.
And by the way, we're very happy that the HEROES Fund made it into last night's House bill that came out last night. But we would also urge you to work to eliminate the New York State carve-out modification to the maintenance of effort provision, which would allow New York State to reduce Medicaid benefits and rights during the pandemic, when an increasing vulnerable population will need home care and long-term care services.
You know, that was a provision that the governor said was very important, and he wanted it in there, and I think Speaker Pelosi wanted to provide that. So to try to make up for that difference, we put a lot of money into state and local, and this package has $1 trillion in state and local money. And there's, I think, $300 billion just for localities. And so that Medicaid money could be made up there. I don't want to see any Medicaid cuts. And so I'm hopeful that despite this provision, that there won't be any cuts to Medicaid. And that if the governor does cut Medicaid, that the money we gave the localities can make up for it.
Yeah, okay, well, thank you. Yeah, because it's, as you understand, Medicaid cuts are also about how people are accessing Medicaid, and that might change if the maintenance of effort is carved out from New York State.
Yeah, I think it's important that we work with the governor to figure out how to meet the needs of people who are on Medicaid so that they can get the resources they need, regardless of the formulas, because he understands this is important. So I'm going to work very hard to get the resources we need.
Thank you very much. So you had mentioned the aid to localities. So will the next funding that is coming through have funds for aid to localities? Because, as you know, New York State, you know, is expecting huge cuts to the counties and human services programs and organizations such as Statewide, and many of the organizations represented here on this line are fearful of cuts that may come.
Yes. So right now we put in that package $1 trillion for state and local. So we're hoping that that stays, because it's not going to become law as written. The Senate has to now negotiate the bill. But we did put in a full $1 trillion because it matters. We tried to get some in the last bill and failed, but we're going to try to make sure this next bill has that money, because most states and cities and localities are out of money, and if they can't raise revenues, then they will have to lay off workers, and nobody wants to lay off our firefighters and our police officers. So it's important that we get the state and localities money. So I'm committed to getting as much as I possibly can, and hopefully we can stick with that $1 trillion.
Thank you. Okay, so now we would like to turn to some other topics. Many of the times, as executive director of Statewide, I travel, or used to travel, the state, and to meet with members and other organizations. And in some areas, what I would find is that there was no internet connections, you know, because of the geography. So some of our members have written to me, especially some in the Hudson Valley and northern in the North Country, talking about how to expand broadband in our country, because they've heard that the FCC chairman on this issue, and who doesn't think that broadband should be a utility, and they point to Europe as having broadband as a utility, and that it seems to work because, you know, they have a lot of connectivity over there. So they're wondering if you have any thoughts on that, and if you would help change his mind.
Yes, I will work very hard to change his mind. I think the net neutrality rules were ones that protected the flow of ideas and commerce. And it also protected the FCC's power to ensure public safety and promote broadband access for communities throughout the country. So I've been a strong supporter of net neutrality, and I've been fighting to get it reinstated ever since the FCC decided to repeal them in 2017. In April, I sent a letter to Chairman Pai of the FCC, and I expressed my deep disappointment in the recent D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals case that upheld the FCC's repeal of the net neutrality rules. In New York State, it's estimated that approximately 338,000 people have no access to broadband during a time when most Americans are now relying heavily on the internet and technology. So I'm on a couple bills, the Keeping Critical Connection Act and the Emergency Education Connections Act. These bills would appropriate $2 billion for Keeping Critical Connections Fund at the FCC to help small broadband providers ensure broadband connectivity for low-income families, and it provides $4 billion for an Emergency Connectivity Fund through the FCC's E-Rate program to provide funding for schools and community libraries to purchase Wi-Fi hotspots, modems, routers, and internet-connected devices for students and patrons to use at home. Now, some of these provisions was actually put in Nancy Pelosi's bill because what we've learned in the trying to teach children at home is that a lot of households don't have internet and don't have tablets or computers. So we want to be able to eventually close the digital divide, particularly between low-income Americans and communities of color and everybody else. So getting that connectivity in place is going to be vital. It's also really important for our older Americans because, again, they're often isolated, and if they don't have access to the internet, it's harder to stay connected to their family and loved ones.
Yeah, absolutely. And for example, when now we're in the pandemic, and the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services has said that we could have telehealth services for patients. But if you don't have connectivity, then you're not able to to benefit from that. And many times when you don't have connectivity, it's because you're in a rural area that doesn't have a lot of resources around there. So this is very important for the community. So switching over to back to a form of economic questions, Barbara from Saratoga says, I'm concerned that we're running up the debt and allowing the rich and big corporations to get away with not paying their fair share of taxes. I worry about the effect of that on my grandchildren. How can we make our tax system more progressive and fair?
The first step, obviously, is to repeal the $2 trillion in Trump tax cuts. That tax cut gave overwhelming amount of taxpayer revenue to the very wealthiest Americans and big multinational corporations. We need to reinstate the state and local tax deduction, the SALT deduction. Taking that away hurt a lot of middle-class Americans, a lot of middle-class New Yorkers. And then when we focus on how to create a fair tax code, we want to make sure we don't reward big companies that send jobs overseas. And we want to make sure that the people who are exceedingly wealthy pay their fair share so that we can have a growing economy again. I would repeal carried interest and capital gains rates. I'd make sure earned income is taxed the same way as unearned income. I would also make sure that wealthy people have the same tax rates as teachers and firefighters. And I think we should be investing in companies that put their employees and community first, like employee-owned businesses and profit-sharing businesses and ones with a common good mission. So I think there's a lot we can do to make our tax code fair, and I'm working on a lot of ideas to do that.
Okay, thank you. A postal issue, and I know I could tell you the United States Post Office these days the service has been very slow, but the question is, how are we going to address the financial crisis that the Postal Office the U.S. Postal Service is confronting? You know, they're talking about privatizing it, and you know, so. I mean, I don't think that's a good solution. So, is there anything that you have thought of to improve this service?
Yeah, I have a couple of really good ideas. So, first of all, I want to make sure that we have vote by mail in place for the November election. And so, I think we should mandate that every state allow vote by mail because we'll still be dealing with COVID. Second, the post office is about to go under in August, so I have requested $20 billion in federal funding in the next COVID package just for the post offices. So I was very happy that the House version had $25 billion in it just for that, so that's good. But my next idea is the big idea, which is return to access to postal banking. Post offices used to be able to provide bank accounts to lower-income working Americans, and they did it for decades, from the turn of the century to 1966. And there's 30,000 post offices in this country in every community, rural, suburban, and in inner city. So if you allowed people to go to the post office, that would help a third of all Americans are unbanked or underbanked. And so they could have a savings account, a checking account, microloans, mortgages, wire money, all basic services that actually begins to close the wealth gap in this country, because people need to be able to save in order to accrue wealth. And it would also create revenue for the post office. It would create $9 billion a year for the post office, and that would make the post office solvent for decades to come.
Pretty innovative.
Good idea. We really want it. I want to get it in COVID 4, but it's going to be hard. But that would be a solution for a lot of people.
And I guess the direct deposits could go into accounts,
yep,
like that for
exactly.
Security like that.
Yep.
Okay. So I wanted to ask or bring to your attention that. I have somebody from Nassau County, his name is Andrew, who's been unemployed since March 10th. He's a freelancer. He photographs professional sports, and he's applied for a New York State unemployment insurance. He hasn't gotten his check yet, any checks yet. and he hasn't been able to speak to any other, to any live worker. And they say that you have to speak to someone on the phone to complete the unemployment insurance claim. So and he's not been able to do it, and he's concerned that his money is just flying out, his savings. Is there any other process that people could do to address this? Because we've heard of a few people who've had trouble applying for unemployment insurance.
Yeah, it's been a disaster. Unemployment is administered by the states. So the New York State Department of Labor has been deeply overwhelmed with individuals trying to apply, and some people just haven't gotten through yet. So what I'd recommend is, first, don't give up. Keep calling every day until you are able to file your unemployment insurance claim. Second, you can ask my office for direct help, so we can provide technical assistance and guidance if, something continues to go wrong. Just email my office at casework@gillibrand.senate.gov, and our staff can help you navigate if it's still not working. But we just don't give up. I haven't heard of many people who've even gotten an unemployment check yet. They're really taking a long, long time. So keep trying, get your name in there, be counted, and then we'll be able to call on your behalf to get you the money that you that will hopefully help you.
So another thing, another topic, the census. We have been promoting the census since last year because we feel that, obviously it's very important to be counted all over, especially as more people are aging into their communities and are going to need more services and more federal help. But somebody, Linda, she's one of our members from Brooklyn, she was saying, said something very interesting. So everybody's filling out the census, but what's going to happen because a lot of people have died, especially, she's in Brooklyn, so there have been a lot of deaths in Brooklyn from COVID and from other things. So how will all of this be affected?
So we have an extension on the census till I think the end of October. So everyone has to fill out their form. Don't forget, it's really important that everyone is counted. All the federal funding formulas are based on how many people. Most of them are based on how many people you have in your state. So formulas for funding for hospitals or transportation, mass transit, all determined based on the local size of the population. So please, everyone on this call, make sure you do fill out the census form. It takes 5 minutes. It's easy. You can do it by paper or online. So please don't forget.
Okay. So now I'm going to go to a political question. And it's not, just to be clear, we do not, as a nonprofit organization, we do not endorse anything, any politics or things like that. But somebody's asking from Saratoga County, Patricia, will the Senate Democrats try to overturn Citizen United if they regain control of the Senate?
Yes. So our goal, at least for me, my goal is to get money out of politics. And I believe that money in politics has a corrupting influence. And I think any so-called unsolvable problem in Washington is unsolvable because there's a special interest group that's blocking progress. So when you want to have green energy, well, it's the fossil fuel industry that's blocking progress. If you want to have voting rights, it's the Koch brothers blocking progress. If you want to end gun violence, it's the NRA blocking progress. And all those individuals and institutions spend a ton of money on campaigns. So I wrote a bill called a bill that basically allows people to run as publicly funded candidates, to call democracy dollars. And the way it works is the way it works in Seattle. If you agree to be publicly funded, then anyone who could vote for you can give you their democracy dollars, meaning they would have a voucher of up to $200 to spend on your campaign. So if you're running for Congress, anyone in your district could give you $200. If you're running for Senate, anyone in your state could give you $200 who signs up to be a not-for-profit publicly funded candidate. And it works in Seattle. It changed who participated, more young people, more communities of color, more women, more low-income people participated in those local elections, and different people ran and different people won. And so it really democratizes our democracy. So I think getting money out of politics is the most important thing we could do. Citizens United was a decision that said money is speech and corporations have the same free speech rights as you and I. I don't agree with either. So eventually I would like to have a constitutional amendment that says money is not speech and corporations do not have the same free speech rights as you and I. But this bill of mine, this Clean Elections Act, it could be voluntary, and so it doesn't go, it's not unconstitutional because individual candidates would agree to do it. So it's an end run around having to get a constitutional amendment, and it could show, prove the case to voters and people that publicly funded elections are stronger and better. So it would help create momentum to end Citizens United.
Thank you for that answer. Okay, so I'm going to ask you something that's a little bit controversial out there right now with this with these payments that are happening for with people who are furloughed. Somebody from Genesee County said, "How is it that many of unemployment are unemployed are bringing home more money not working than when they work with the $600 a week additional money that they're getting from the federal government?" Now those furloughed at jobs are making more than those of us left to continue to work and pick up the extra duties of those that were laid off. How are the workers that are still working, that remain, being compensated for shouldering the loads and stress, especially if we're not frontline workers?
So I think the additional $600 for unemployed or furloughed individuals was intended to be a lifeline for those unable to work during the pandemic. And I strongly believe that individuals still working during this time should be compensated with hazard pay. And I'm going to fight to make sure that that's what's included in the next COVID package. But it's just a short-term thing, and it's so that people who are lowest income wouldn't starve during the 3 months or 4 months of the economy being shut down. So I think things will be up and running, but I don't think I think that the people who are critical workers should have time and a half, and that's why we have the Heroes Fund.
Thank you. Yes, and I could say that Heroes Fund will do a lot of good for people like home care workers and you know healthcare workers who are seeing people in the community, as well as you know others who have to get up every day to make sure that the community runs, even if we're at a reduced pace right now. Okay, so this question is about healthcare, about Medicaid. The advance of modern science have enabled disabled people to live for many years with their conditions, giving rise to the need for long-term care health at home or in nursing homes. Medicaid by default has become the health insurance program for such care. Should income limitations be raised or eliminated to allow more people eligibility? Should the employment eligibility requirement for single able-bodied applicants for Medicaid be suspended for the duration of the epidemic?
Yes, I think that we need to make sure as many folks as possible are able to be covered for care. Raising income limitations and in some cases eliminating them entirely will be an important tool for expanding coverage. Suspending employment eligibility requirements will be another important tool.
Okay, thank you. So I'm going to ask Mario Henry, who is our president. He had some questions. So I'm going to ask him if he can. You had two questions, Mario?
I'm here. Yeah, two questions. You can hear me, right?
Yep. Yes.
Good. Okay. Do we need a much larger home health care program? If yes, how do we do it?
Yes. I am co-sponsor of the Home Health Care Planning Improvement Act, and that would allow more health care providers to prescribe and ultimately provide home care. I've been fighting for more funding for home health, including protections for workers like hazard pay and personal protective equipment. We also need to raise the wages of home health aides. They're among the lowest paid workers in America, so we need to give them a living wage indexed to inflation. And I want to have this thing called the health force, which would train 1 million workers in healthcare to support COVID relief. They would do the testing, the contact tracing, eventually therapeutics and vaccines, and they could then, as a career, be trained as home health aides to expand access. But we want to make these, again, really living wage jobs with good benefits. So we would try to create a pipeline to increase access to home care.
That is wonderful news, because we at Statewide, we co-lead along with the Mercy Care for the Adirondacks a home care crisis workforce shortage.
Oh, that's
campaign.
Great. We could utilize you to train our health force. If we could pass the health force, then you guys could be one of the trainers.
Absolutely. We could talk about that when it happens. That would be great. Go ahead, Mario.
Okay, next question. One near and dear to me. Social Security is critical to the financial well-being of senior citizens. Almost all seniors rely heavily on Social Security for financial security, and for many, it is their sole source of income. In roughly 10 years, the program will not be able to pay full benefits to recipients. Could you comment on it?
Yes. So I believe we need to strengthen and expand Social Security. Senator Sanders and I wrote a bill that would blow the cap on the input to the Social Security. So any earnings over $250,000 would also be applied toward Social Security. And we'd have an updated cost of living adjustment. And those two changes would extend the trust fund by 75 years. So it would make a huge difference to just add more funding and to blow the cap and to do a COLA.
Thank you.
Excellent.
Okay, so another question comes from one of our board members, actually from Manhattan, from the Bronx. Her name is Lowell Green. And this is also about the mail delivery. So she says that the post office is moving from salary letter carriers to hourly personal. There are areas in the Bronx that have had problems for a while, but now it's worse. And that she heard from a friend of hers in Manhattan that her senior building is not getting any mail, let alone getting mail picked up. Most of the residents do not have computers, have direct deposit of checks, as well as get medicine delivered. So the mail obviously is the mail service is obviously an important service to us.
That sounds horrible. So that's why I'm really focused on the post office, because it is literally about to go out of business. So we want to fund it with this $25 billion, as well as getting rid of the mandate that they have to fund their benefits for 75 years in advance. That's something, they're the only entity in America that has to do that. So we want that plus postal banking. So I'm going to make sure that the Postal Service has the revenue that it needs and the support it needs. I think it's really important that we do have vote by mail up and running too, because I assume COVID is going to be with us in November. So for our older Americans, we want to have vote by mail so they don't have to expose themselves. We want to have curbside voting so they don't have to expose themselves. And we need to have early voting. So if they do want to go in person, we can stretch it out over many weeks so they can, again, minimize exposure. It's really important that COVID not take away our constitutional right to vote. And the way to protect is to fix the post office. So I'm very focused on fixing the post office. And hopefully, if we do get that money, that at least the residents can start getting their mail delivered again. But I can look into that specifically to see what's going on. I can put a call into the post office today and find out why Riverdale's not getting their mail delivered.
Thank you. Senator, I wanted you to explain a little bit about the this legislation that you introduced to create direct supply chains between farms and food banks. Would that be, could you please tell us?
Sure. So one of the things I've been finding out around the state is that a lot of our farmers, their markets have dried up because they used to deliver to schools and to other places that now aren't working, like concert venues and sporting venues. And so we needed to create a better pipeline from food, from the food production to the actual people who need it. And so I wrote some legislation to create a streamlined process for farmers to be able to have food delivered at food banks and other feeding centers, so that people, particularly those who are affected by the crisis, get food they need. You know, we've heard too many sad stories of dairy farmers having to dump their dairy milk because they had nowhere to deliver it. So this bill would address that concern and make that that fresh milk and fresh produce readily available to feeding centers and food banks.
You know, and I would say, I mean, so one thing that the pandemic has done is has magnified a lot of things, you know, wrong with the system or certain deficiencies. But I really think that food insecurity is one of the biggest problems that senior citizens in particular have. You know, the rate of food insecurity for just the average person in New York State is at almost 20%. So I think that if we can get more programs that would encourage people to take advantage of programs like this, would, you know, even without a pandemic, would be something that would be good
true, because, you know, people shouldn't have to go to bed hungry in this country, the wealthiest country in the world. And it's bizarre that the Republican Senate doesn't want to increase access to SNAP and food benefits. It's ridiculous. So one of our big priorities for the COVID-4 bill is to have more money for SNAP. Millions of Americans are out of work. They're definitely in need of food. And why we would deny that of people is outrageous. So I'm very, very focused on food security for our older Americans as well as those who are out of work right now.
And Maria, this is Gil. We're going to have to wrap in just a minute here. So if there's any last closing thoughts, sorry to interrupt. It's been a great conversation.
Oh, okay. Well, wonderful. Well, so in that case, I was going to thank the senator for the extra money that was sent, the funding for the administration of community living that gave New York State, you know, $50 million extra for things like food and home care and other services, and, you know, including transportation at a time when the vulnerable populations that are seniors and the disabled need it the most. But if you have any other things that you would like to tell us as you close, we want to really thank you so much for taking such a great amount of time with us and being so generous with your time with the members of Statewide.
I just want to thank you for convening this call, Maria. This is so helpful to me to hear your questions and to see what's on people's minds. My job is to serve you and to lift up your voices and to make sure they're being heard as we write legislation and try to fix the problems being caused by COVID and just some of the challenges that you face every day. I want to thank everyone on the call for participating. And just know that we will get through this. We are a strong and resilient people. And I know that we will overcome and we will defeat COVID. And I just want to thank everyone who is out there helping and advocating for our critical workers and our first responders. And I'm here to serve all of you. So thank you so much for being on the call, and thank you for hosting it.
Thank you very much. And good luck with the rest of the year.
Yeah, well, we can do this again. But thank you so much, Maria.
Okay, bye-bye.
God bless.
All right. Well, everybody, thank you so much. Again, if you would like to listen to this or share this with anybody, feel free to check our website out at nyseenior.org tomorrow, and we'll have a recording of this session. And just also, while you're at it, you could call us at 800-333-4374 and or our website, nyseenior.org, with any concerns that you may have. Thank you so much.